You're listening to Face Off, episode 48, recorded December 19th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, Mark. A couple interesting notes. First of all, it's getting close to CES.
Yes.
And we're going to that. We're pretty excited.
CES is like a computer and technology kind of...
Yeah, it stands for the Consumer Electronics Show, which really encompasses a lot. It's like one of the bigger trade shows out there.
So, it's a big conference that me and you are both going to in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be pretty interesting. It's my first time ever going to any kind of conference like this.
Mm-hmm.
Being that it's a computer technology conference, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, me too. I've never been anything like this. This is going to be a first time for both of us. We're going with two of our friends who have never been to anything like this either. So it'll definitely be a wild ride.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that there's a lot of, it's kind of the gadget show, but I think I'm also really hoping to try and find some web apps and some other companies out there doing cool stuff that we can talk about on the show. Maybe try and get some interviews or something like that lined up.
Definitely.
We're both pumped. We're going to try and meet Leo Laporte, which we're really excited about. He's like the king of technology.
Yeah, he's definitely like the grandfather of podcasting,
I would say.
So that would be the 8th through the 11th, I believe.
Yeah.
So what episode would that be for our listeners? Like what?
I think we come back on our other big news that we want to talk about is our 50th episode is coming up.
Will that be our 50th episode?
I think when we get back will be our 50th.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
I don't have my calendar thing going.
But yeah, so a couple big milestones coming up. We're really excited.
So yeah, we're going to, when we come back, I guess we'll talk about what we saw there and all the cool, you know, web apps and all the stories of people we've met.
So our 50th episode will be right before we go to CES.
Okay.
And so we come back and our 51st episode will be, well, actually, no, we're going to have to probably record a show before CES so that we can release it because we come back that Monday when we normally release the show the next day. I don't think we're going to be able to record one ahead of time. But
okay.
So then probably the 52nd episode will be our big post-CES.
We get to talk about showdown. What we saw and what we found and things. So.
Hope people won't hate me on Twitter because I have a feeling I'll probably be tweeting a lot of cool stuff out there.
Well, it'll be fun anyways.
Yeah. And our 50th episode, that's pretty exciting.
So our 50th is right before CES then?
Yep.
Okay. What date?
That would be, it'll be released on the 4th of January.
So that's pretty big. I mean, that's halfway to 100.
Yeah.
Good number.
Yeah, we're excited.
That's a lot.
What is it? How many weeks in a year? 50. Oh, man. I can't.
52.
Is it 52?
Oh.
Something like that. Anyway, so it's coming up almost on a year of Face Off. So the 50th episode, it's kind of weird because, you know, years don't end 52. In like...
52.177457, of course, because there's not 365.
Thank you, Google.
It's funny because it has like the little Google calculation, too. It's not just like a Yahoo answer or something.
Yeah.
So I was kind of right.
So, I mean, it's kind of our celebration of, let's say, a year of Face Off. 50 episodes. I'm pretty proud.
Yeah, me too.
Hopefully we can keep it's going to keep happening. The show will keep rolling on and on to several more numbers.
Yep.
So check it out. CES and our 50th episode is coming up. Let's get into our news and follow-ups. Our first news follow-up item is that Evernote has an Android app.
This is both great and kind of frustrating at the same time, because I went in there and got the beta version of this like 3 days before they released the actual one. Like I had to go in and manually install it.
Yeah,
it wasn't easy. But I am glad that it came to Android, and it's nice because I see a lot of companies just making iPhone apps.
Yeah,
and you know that was great since I had an iPod Touch, and I was able to install them and things. But
totally.
Now I feel like I got an Android, and I want to be part of the, you know. I want to be able to try out these new products and like Evernote cool and things totally. Like this. And now that it's come to Android, that's awesome. But
yeah, and the thing is, like, when you have it on the iPod Touch, you can view your notes. That's cool. But with this, like, you can use the camera to take, you know, pictures of stuff to put them in your notes, which is great. But like, I think you made a really good point. Sort of the big news of this is that companies are starting to recognize that Android is a platform, and Apple really doesn't have sort of that exclusive, you know, if you want really cool mobile apps, this is the only way to go.
The other thing is Android is pretty much open marketplace. There's no like lengthy like approval process and
totally.
So I think we're going to see a lot more of these kind of apps getting ported over to Android.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing though is what Android does suffer from that iPod did a little bit, not so much now, is these sort of mobile apps, they call them, that basically launch a web browser for you. And I hate that.
Yeah.
Even the Facebook app sometimes for stupid things launches the mobile browser. And I'm like, well, no, I should be able to do that within the app. What's the point of an app?
You know, one of the things that I found with a Droid after using it a little bit, it's really, it's more of an operating system than, well, we know Android's an operating system, but I mean, it feels more of an operating system than the Apple iPhone, as far as like some of these apps will ask you what you prefer. Like, for example, the Twitter app that I've got, it's like, well, how do you want to open your image? Do you want to use a web browser? Do you want to use this other web browser? Because I have two now. Or do you want to view it in our like special little picture viewer?
Yeah.
Whereas the iPhone would just do whatever it can do. It doesn't.
And if you click on a YouTube link, it's like, hey, do you want to, you know, if you're on Twitter and you click on a YouTube link, it's like, do you want to open this in the browser or with the YouTube client? Which I think if you go to the YouTube browser, it'll open up the YouTube client anyways. Oh. But it's nice that it's smart enough to figure that out for you. And that definitely is integrated in the operating system. Like there's certain things too, like the apps can tell the operating system what they can do. You know, like PingDroid, which I used to post to ping.fm. If I take a picture, you can click the share button, and it has registered itself in the operating system as an app that can share pictures.
Yeah, that's a great, really cool. That's a great example. You just take a picture, and it's like, oh, do you want to put it on Twitter? Do you want to put it here? Do you want to text it to somebody?
Totally.
Yeah.
So that's great. Lots of cool apps coming out for the Droid, and I'm just glad to see that. I mean, you know, I really love my iPod Touch. Now that I have a Droid, I don't really use it that much at all. But for a while there, you know, especially with a lot of these iPhone apps, the cool ones were really iPhone only because they used the camera and stuff like that. And it was almost kind of disheartening because you'd be like, oh, man, I heard about this really, really cool, you know, iPod app. And you'd open it up and be like, ah, you can't use it because you need the phone for this. And I'm like, ah. But now that there's some competition, you know, people are putting out apps for both platforms, which I really like. I've seen a lot of cross-platform apps, too, that I have used on the iPod Touch that now have Android apps that I can use them and be happy.
And they work just the same or better because it's, you know, got the tight integration of whether you can do this on here, like the YouTube thing you said.
Totally.
So the next thing we want to talk about is Etherpad.
Yeah.
Which we talked about in episode 6. And I mean, we used it for a while as our like show notes, to do our show notes, to share them. And we could actually add to our show notes while the show is going on.
Yeah, it's super hyper real-time document collaboration. So with Google Docs, if you use it after a while, you sort of realize that it's collaboration, but it's not super real-time. Like, you save it. Sometimes you and I collide when we're working on a show notes and docs.
Sometimes I try to save before you.
Do that. Etherpad didn't do that at all. It was hyper realistic. You know, I type one character, you saw it, and it, you know, differentiated. We liked it. It was a great program. Well, it got bought by Google because they want the team to work on Google Wave.
Which makes sense because Google Wave is trying to basically do the same thing, but add all these like gadgets and bots.
Totally. Like we said, I don't really like Google Wave, so I'm kind of sad to see that happen. I mean, I'm glad that they're recognizing people are doing good things like the people that did Etherpad. But, you know, apparently Etherpad, when they got bought out, you know, they said no more pro accounts. You know, we're not going to allow people to sign up for accounts anymore because we're getting bought out. We're trying to sunset this service. And there was so much outcrying of support that they actually released the Etherpad app as open source.
That's awesome.
That's great.
So basically, the app is still there for anyone to do anything they want with it.
Totally.
Except Google now gets the team that built it to help integrate into Google Wave.
Which Google has been, and I'm sure they had, passed this by Google before they did that. And Google's been known to do that. They did it with Jaiku, too. They bought Jaiku. They were trying to do things with it. It ended up, they realized that Twitter had too much steam, so they couldn't use Jaiku. So they opened up, they released the Jaiku source for free. That's cool. Just like there's already a replacement for Etherpad, iEtherpad.com you found.
And PiratePad.com.
PiratePad.com.
It's funny, their comments were like, oh, I pirated open source software. And they made it. It's kind of neat. But basically, if you like the Etherpad service the way it was when we talked about it in episode 6, you could just use it the way it was.
And it's written in Scala.
Really?
Yeah.
It's at this like dynamic Java.
something style, like I don't know. I remember we were talking about it at one point, but because I actually looked at it, because I was like, "Oh,
well,
man,
Twitter's
I
written in Scala now. It used to be Rails."
Yeah.
Well, part of the API part, I think.
And Reddit was too. No, or Reddit's the Python
Reddit's,
one.
Reddit's web.py.
Web.py. Okay. But yeah, I actually looked at it because I was like, "Well, I want to install my own Etherpad," and then it was like a technology that I wasn't really familiar with, and I was like, "All right, never mind."
Oh, you thought it was like PHP or something?
Yeah, I think they actually use a DocumentDB too, but I cannot confirm that. But check it out if you want. You know, if you want to make your own Etherpad, I'm sure it'd be good code to look at for an idea if you want to do sort of hyper collaborative stuff. But again, thank you, Google. We appreciate that you actually listen to the community and don't just leave us out in the cold.
Yep. Speaking of leaving people in the cold, we got some. If you're in the cold, you want some hot cocoa or
yeah. This is this week's geek tool, which we did a sort of a Christmas shopping list episode a couple weeks back. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? But anyways, it got us to realize that you and I mean, while we really love web technology, we love technology in general. So each week now, we're gonna try and look for cool little things that you can find and buy out on the internet that are really cool. So right now, as Mark and I are recording the show, we are drinking coffee.
And it is not your normal coffee.
Yeah, so I guess a regular coffee pot that you put your grounds in and stuff like that. But I found that really the only time it got used is when you would come over to record. My wife doesn't drink a whole lot of coffee, and there's a lot of times that like it, 8 o'clock at night, I really want a cup of coffee, so I want decaf, but only a cup. I don't need to make a full pot for that.
Mm-hmm.
So what we bought was a Keurig, and I think that's how you pronounce it, Keurig B30 Mini Brewer. And you can get the link to this at the show notes. But what it is a great little coffee machine that you put in what they call these K-cups. So they're single-serving bits of coffee. It's basically a little cup with a little filter in it and coffee in it. You put it in the machine, it punctures it on both sides, pours hot water in it, and gives you a cup of coffee.
So no longer does it brew it and hold it in a little kettle, yeah. And you have too much coffee. You get cup by cup what you want. Also, I mean, what other advantages does this give us?
Well, the other has really cool stuff because you don't just have to do coffee, too. They have tea cups. They have cocoa cups. But really, it's just when you want a cup of coffee, or you can, the nice thing about the K-cups is you can get a bunch of different types of coffee. So I bought like a giant box of decaf from this one company, but you can on the internet find these sort of variety packs where you get a bunch of different types of coffee. You know, sometimes I found out where the office where I work, some people don't like coffee or don't like a particular brand of coffee. I think like I bought some Folgers last week and everybody spent the entire week complaining about the Folgers just because it was cheap. And I was at the store and I was like, well, I want to make sure we have coffee in the office. But I learned my lesson. I'll never buy Folgers again. People whining like you wouldn't believe. But
so this gives you the ability to have kind of like a 10 different flavor variety style pack with like tea and hot chocolate as well.
Yeah, it's like really good for an office situation where people really don't agree on it. And, you can have tea, cocoa, things like that. But I know what you're thinking. These K-cups are not cheap. I mean, they're obviously not as cheap as buying a big thing of coffee with filters and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, what if I run out of these K-Cups and I really want some coffee? So the other thing that we're going to talk about is called the Keurig K-Cup Reusable Coffee Filter. And this is cool. It's like a little coffee thing that's about the size of a K-Cup with a filter inside that you can put your own regular coffee in. So, if they don't have the variety you like or you like it, a particular blend or something like that, you can get this little reusable filter, put it in your little coffee maker and make do with it.
So you just use you could use your Folgers. Crappy Folgers, stick it in this thing and put it in the coffee machine. You're ready to go.
I could do that. Yep.
Awesome.
So check them out. I really like it. I still keep my regular coffee maker around in case I have, a group of people I can make a full pot of coffee. But, day to day, when I'm at home, especially at work, I drink a lot of coffee. But when I'm at home, I usually like one or two cups of coffee, like with breakfast on the weekends. Mm-hmm. It's really good for that.
Awesome.
So check out the links in the show notes, and if you get one or have one, there's other systems out there too, like this, the Philips, I think, Senseo systems with these little pads instead of the cups. But check them out. Single serve coffee.
So this is this week's geek tool.
Yeah.
Then
our geek tool of the week. All right. So keep you up late coding. Drink your coffee.
All right, so let's get into the web apps. The first one we got is TweetCall. What's TweetCall?
TweetCall is this really silly web app that you sign up for. It gives you a PIN number and a phone number, and you call that phone number, and and you put in your PIN number, and then it's like, all right, say your tweet, hang up when you're done. And you're like, oh, man, I'm walking down the street, and it's really hot out. And then hang up, and it transcodes it and then tweets it out for you.
Cool. I see this being useful for the people that text and drive.
Yeah, totally.
That's terrible. They could just call this number and say what they're doing or whatever status they want to update, and it transcribes and throws it up on Twitter.
Yes.
Awesome.
It isn't perfect, though.
Uh-oh.
I tweeted something out, and it missed one word out of the whole tweet. But
it's better than Google Translate sometimes.
Man. Yeah, the Google Voice transcription of your voicemails. If you
it's hilarious.
Man.
It's some of the highlights of my day sometimes, reading some of those.
Yeah, they actually recently implemented a thing where you can sign up to donate your voicemails to them to help them make the transcoding
better. Can you pick which voicemails to send them?
I'm not sure, because I sure as heck didn't do that. I don't want them listening to my voicemails.
Well, I wouldn't mind it if it was just a random, stupid general voice, but...
Yeah, that's true.
Like, if you could pick and choose, it would be okay, but if it was just all or nothing...
I don't know. To do a follow-up on that, whether or not you can, because... Yeah, I'm with you on that. I wouldn't be able to pick and choose which one. But anyways, it works well enough, that's for sure. Check it out, tweetcall.com.
Interesting. So what's the next web app?
Web app we're going to look at is called Instant Jury. And have you and I, we get into our fair share of disputes. Never anything serious, but sometimes we just can't really come up to an agreement. A website like Instant Jury lets you go on there, you both sign up, and you present your arguments, and people can sign up to be in the jury, and they decide who wins the argument.
So this is geared towards more of the arguments that cannot be settled by a quick Google search?
Absolutely. Like. Yeah. It's not like I signed up to be a jury for one, and the story was this guy and his girlfriend found a mouse in their apartment, and, just one mouse. And she freaked out and wanted to call an exterminator. And he was like, let's just put a couple mice traps out there and see what we can get, So they couldn't come to an agreement about it. So they put it out on Instant Jury. And I heard, you set up a timeline for it. And so, like you say, when they say that, the prosecution is giving their arguments, it basically means they're just preparing what they write. And then they submit it in text and you read it. And then the defendant gets to do the same. And then there's a period of jury deliberation where all the jury members can go in and vote for which side wins. And then a decision is handed down.
That's awesome. It's got a little timeline, like plaintiff files the case and the defendant appears in court. And then they both put in their arguments. This guy won by a landslide.
Yeah.
88%.
I've seen a couple out there that it's silly. Like one guy, this was terrible, actually. He would find these little lizards in his house. And he would, dispose of them in the garbage disposal. And his friend was like, dude, that's not right. And he was like, what are you talking about? It's just, it's humane. And so he put it up on Instant Jury. And he lost.
Like he was killing them in the garbage disposal? Or just storing them there?
No.
Letting them stink.
You don't store things in a... in an appliance designed to grind up food and shove it through your pipes.
Oh, that. I thought you meant a garbage compactor.
No, not a compactor. Oh. A garbage disposal.
Oh, that is terrible. That is terrible.
Lost. So hopefully, and I was part of that jury, hopefully I'm saving Lizard somewhere in the world now by telling him he shouldn't do that.
Oh, I can only imagine that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff on there. So it's a great way to settle a dispute and have strangers sell it. If sometimes when you're in a relationship with someone and you're like, my friend said, and she says, my friend said that you're wrong. Well, this is strangers deciding for you. So if you both put your fate into the system, then you can come up with a settlement of what should happen.
Sweet.
Yeah, so that is Instant Jury. I want to remind you guys, if you have some news, follow-ups, or web application you want us to look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you guys. Let's get into our topic for the week, Mark.
All right, so the topic here is programming, workflow, and best practices. And this can probably be applied to web development and design as well.
This was requested, actually, by Mike Henderson on Twitter. So he requested kind of his thoughts. I think he's really curious about, because you and I mean, we have fairly different workflows. I have a very, I have a professional one at work. where it's not really dictated by me. It's dictated by my coworkers and our superiors. And then I have sort of my own personal workflow, which integrates some parts of both things, but not. And I mean, you sort of have the same.
Well, you have a lot of collaboration, I would say, and I am a single, you know, like the Lone Ranger programmer.
Lone Ranger programmer, yes.
So I have to kind of, I have to go out on myself and try to better myself and find better best things to do. And I've come up from, you know, doing things that would be considered almost the worst thing to things that it would be considered almost, you know, industry-wide best practices.
Totally.
It's not really force-fed to me. It's not, you know, oh, you have to use this certain type of thing. And I'm like in charge. It's like, here, I have a project. I have users saying I would like to do this, this, and this, and I have to go in and just make it happen. So where with you, you have kind of a project leader, I would say, maybe, and
it's very democratic, actually, which is kind of funny. Most of our processes don't really come down on high from above. There's just a lot of us that really want to try and be the best programmers that we can, so we work really hard to try and do best practices. But there have been some things like, we have discussed pair programming, and finally there was sort of a mandate from our boss that we needed to do X hours of pair programming a week. So, very interesting.
Okay, so what we're going to do here is talk about the various tools and various best practices that we kind of know about.
Totally.
There might be other ones that, you know, we don't know much about, and we'd like you to send them in and let us know.
Absolutely. Or, I mean, if we're wrong, I mean, as far as I know, it's one of those things where I'm only hearing one side of the argument. So, when we first heard of pair programming, we thought, well, that's, of course, that works. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to go. And I've actually read some articles where people have said, you know, people think pair programming is a silver bullet, but it always isn't, you know?
Right.
And I'm starting to realize that it works. So when
I would say some of these things can be controversial, but a lot of these that are going to talk about are kind of black and white. Like you should probably be using this.
Totally.
For example, version control.
Absolutely. Source control management is essential.
So you kind of brought me into the world of version control. Mm-hmm. This is something that was foreign to me a few years back. And when I learned about it, I was like, wow, why would I not use this?
Totally.
This is one of those, I think, black and white.
Yeah, even if you're by yourself, and a lot of people don't do it because they're programming by themselves, and it's really easy to explain the sort of tangible benefits of doing source code management with someone else, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, most of these are built to, you know, allow a person to commit their work, and you have to merge it with their work, and it creates a good system for working with other people. You don't have to do the old, like, here's my code on a USB disk, you know, it's just terrible.
Well, I already rewrote that function. Why'd you rewrite it? Well, I didn't know you were rewriting it.
Or like Dreamweaver, I think, has built-in sort of FTP things
it
kind of tries to do source code management via FTP because no one did it. You know, they use Dreamweaver. So I think, I mean, we've talked about these. We had a big thing on source control management hosting. But basically, in that episode, we talked about a lot of them. Like, there is Subversion, which is very popular. We use Git and Mercurial, which even if you're programming by yourself, these are totally invaluable. I've had to get out of my sort of Subversion workflow now, and remember that I'm working with Git, and as soon as I finish a functional piece of code, I need to commit it because I need to be able to separate that both, you know, in the log and in my workflow. Like, let's say I finish one piece of functional code and I don't commit it, but then I start working on another one. And let's say I just screw it up more than you've ever seen things screwed up before and I can't get it back. I've lost that chunk of functional code. So you work, you get something functional, commit it, and then go on to the next thing.
Would you say you do a lot of multi-programmer collaboration on a single program? With version control, or do you find yourself logging yourself into some sort of a project and doing some stuff and then committing?
Both. I mean, there's some times where it's just my own project and I create a Git repo for it so I can manage it myself. And then all of our projects at work have the ability for any other programmer to check it out, do work, and push it up.
Mainly, I've used version control as a single programmer. And the benefits still, to me, are, you know, outweighs. I mean, there's almost no, you know, work required to use a version control system, especially with like things like Dropbox, where every computer is synced up. You know, you can just get stuff, and the source code management options that we talked about as well make it easy to get the code at any time. What I use it for is, branching is awesome if I want to work on some new feature, but I still want to work on bugs. Like if somebody comes to me and says, oh, there's this bug and I need it fixed I want to download the code today, like right away. And you're like, I'm working on this new, if you didn't have version control, you'd be like, well, I was working on this new feature and now I have to finish it now before I can... fix your bug.
I don't want to sound like a jerk doing it, but I want to correct you. It is source code management, not version control. Because versioning is a very integral part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But like what you're talking about, like branching and merging, that really hits into the source code management. It's an application designed to manage your source code for you and with other people as far as integration goes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think I've called it version control the rest of my life too, but like branching and merging and stuff isn't really version type things, but it's really important to help you sort out your source code.
Right.
Which is, like you said, that's a great example of working on new features on old software.
Well, the other thing too is a lot of programmers can sometimes be scared that they're going to break something in their code. With version control, you have backups of previous versions that haven't worked in the past. So you can just go crazy with it and then be like, oh, this is just junk.
Totally.
Revert back to a previous working version.
Oh, totally. I've done that with Subversion when you realize that a feature broke, but it broke X versions ago. You don't know which one, where you're like, with Subversion, it's like SVN revert to like revision 14, and then you run it and you're like, nope, broken revision 13, still broken 12. Okay, it worked. So something between 12 and 13 broke it, and then you can diff between them to see what's wrong.
And then some people might say, well, why don't I just do a backup or something? As a single developer, well, a multi-developer, it makes sense to use source control management. With a single developer, what if you want to pull from 3 versions ago one part of the code and then like a piece of the code from 2 versions ago? This allows you to do that. It gives you more granular ability to pull pieces of code together.
Yeah, and that's so. It's so easy. I know guys at work who have been using Git for a long time that are really hardcore about it. They even do things like before they do any work whatsoever, they start their own branch because they want to make sure that. They just like to separate anything that they do from everyone else so that they can, it doesn't affect anyone else because they merge it and then, push it up later. But, it's just sort of the way they like to really separate anything they're doing. And that way, too, they know that, with that, it's any file that you've touched, you can see what's different than the other branch. And with Git, it's really flexible. You can just merge it and throw it up to, if you have a central repository, throw it up there.
So that about wraps it up for the version control. Would you say that is basically a best practice that most programmers should be using?
Absolutely. I think once you really get into it, and most people, it's really hard to explain how to use it. It has a learning curve, but the second you actually use it and realize how beneficial it is, you'll say, how did I ever do any coding without it? It sounds rude, but I almost don't trust a programmer that doesn't use... I know people that are using Git and Mercurial for like their configuration files on their computer. just because it makes sense, right? I want to track what changes happen to this.
Yeah.
Or like if, multiple people have access to the computer, they'll go in and check it into Git and then something's different and they know that they didn't edit it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think, yeah. You have to do some form of source code management or it's something not right.
The other thing is, we talked about this in the source code management episode, but the newer ones like Mercurial and Git are so easy. You don't have to set up a server or anything. So.
Totally. I think adoption has been low previously is because, CVS and Git were CVS and Subversion were the big ones.
Required servers.
And they require a server, and it almost is a pain to like add a new repository to them. It's, but with, Git and Mercurial, you just go into the directory. And if you have those programs installed, you just say, I'm creating a Git repo here. I'm creating a Mercurial repo here. Super easy. And what's great about those two is, they're distributed. So it doesn't affect anyone else's workflow. You could, I could use Git on one of my projects and, it doesn't affect anyone else. It, with Subversion, you have to have that server. You have to be interacting with that.
Yeah, you got to kind of make sure your code is good enough, to go up there into the
server. That's another thing. You can create a local branch for yourself, and if, you can still commit even though the code isn't perfect because you're not merging and pushing up to your other programmers.
Sure.
Wow, so, that was long.
So, well, it's worth it. I mean, that's,
I think it's very important. Absolutely.
The next one is documentation. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're spending all this time making this program and you really want somebody to use it or reuse the code, you know, if you're making something internally for your corporation or mm-hmm. company, and you know, you want this code to be used by people, and you know, maybe they write another app and they want to reuse it. If they mm-hmm. can't, if there's no documentation, it's kind of worthless. I mean, yeah. You want to, you know,
documentation is one of those things that programmers don't like to do. No one really likes to do it a whole lot, right. Except for when you really need that documentation and it's not there.
Yeah.
Then you're like, man, I need people to document. And then a week later, you stop documenting things because you forgot about it. But yeah, it's really important. It's just one of those things. I'm really terrible about this. I think that everything I do is super intuitive. I mean, I in my head think that any piece of code I write, you could look at and figure out in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. But that's not the truth at all.
No.
I mean, there's so many things that go into any sort of code that is written, such as, you know, the history as to why. Like, what is the actual reason that a person built this app? What were the conversations you had with the actual stakeholders about it? I mean, that's the stuff that goes in documentations that you, even if you look at the code, you can never figure out.
Yeah. And, you know, there's some great documentation. Generators or there's different kinds. I mean, there's technical generators that can actually pull comments out of code and make like a nice HTML format out of them. Mm-hmm. There's one, you know, wiki style ones where you can go in there and just start banging away. And they make these for different languages, you know, PHP, almost, I would say every language probably totally. Has their own, you know, PHP, Java, Ruby, you know, Python, mm-hmm. they all have one. And, I mean, your company might have like a standard. You guys have like a standard. You got to use this to do your documentation.
Or? Well, I mean, we do everything in Rails, which you know pretty much has RDoC in it.
Yeah.
But other than that, we don't have a whole lot of standards on it, and that's kind of disconcerting right now. Another part that goes with documentation, though, is commenting your code. See, there's two types of documentation. There's like your user documentation, your technical documentation, and a lot of that is the comments in your code. Mm-hmm. That is a form of documentation. That's technical documentation for other programmers mm-hmm. or anyone else looking through your code. The most standard is that, I mean, you need to comment anything that you think might be tricky at all, which mm-hmm. again is sort of a hard statement to make, right? Because I think everything's super intuitive, but I also had a programmer who's a friend that was a math major, and what he thought was intuitive was completely non-intuitive to me in any way, shape, or form. So, yeah. You know, he would think in his head, like, should I comment this? Like, no, this math function makes total sense to anyone. And I would look at it, I'm like, what are you doing?
And, you know, there's different types of comments, too. A lot of these languages have the ability to, like, wiki-style links and things.
Yep.
Python even has, you can do example code in comments, and it will test that code
nice.
To make sure it works.
That's great.
And that means that will work in your documentation.
Yeah.
So somebody's not looking at your documentation and trying to run it and be like, this doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, how many people look at documentation for, like, PHP?
Like, you copy, write it once,
paste.
And then,
yeah. Oh, man, this example doesn't work at all.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say documentation. I mean, if the program took you longer than, I don't know, a couple hours to write, you should probably have some documentation.
Yeah, I mean, really, you should just, and just again, you need to think about what would happen. You know, everyone uses the bus metaphor. This is a, you know, if you got hit by a bus today, what would happen? Well, okay, this programmer would have to take over my projects. Would they be able to figure out what they need to do from that? And this is tough. No one wants to write documentation. It's definitely the non-sexy part of programming, you know?
It's funny because it's one of those things that they don't like to do. Programmers don't like to write it, but they hate it when it's not there. When
yeah,
they're looking
totally.
At somebody else's program.
Totally. I know it's you're really angry when there isn't enough documentation because you can't figure it out. All right. Well, we're going to have to continue this one next week because we got a lot more to talk about in this topic. I want to remind you guys, if you want to subscribe to the show, you can do so by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can subscribe by email, RSS, all kinds of ways. And if you want to leave feedback for the show, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback and give us any sort of feedback. We always appreciate it. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week.